Christina Bowen. Christina is a knowledge ecologist working on topics like collective intelligence, global warming, and systems theory. In this conversation, we talk about the relationship between trust and collective intelligence, how to solve wicked problems, and the nature of self-organization. Please enjoy this conversation with knowledge ecologist Christina Bowen. Welcome, Christina, to the show. It's so good to have you here. Christina is a knowledge ecologist working out of California, and I met her for the first time on a organizational design community online, and we'll get a little bit into what that kind of geeky subject is. But the first thing I wanted to ask you, Christina, is what is a knowledge ecologist, and what is knowledge ecology?
Well, people have a general idea of what an ecologist is, somebody who looks at plants and animals living in their habitat and how they share the different flows of energy and materials that go through the system. So if you think of a wetland ecologist looking at sunlight or nitrogen or any other flow that goes through the wetland system, they can track it through its origin to the plants, to the fish, to the fish decaying and feeding the trees, and all of the cycles that we look at. And I think of knowledge ecology as looking at the flows of information, and not only tracking the actual information flows, which can be more or less difficult to do depending on how qualitative or quantitative the information is and how easy it is to see, but also setting up an environment in which information flows easily and readily. And so the people within the organization are able to act with full intelligence and agency. So having a healthy organizational ecology is very, very important to having agile, adaptive organizations.
Awesome. And we talked a little bit about this on a previous phone call, but I'm curious if you could explore with listeners what experiences in your life sort of brought you to this work.
Well, I started out in environmental science, and I loved wetlands, obviously, since I used that metaphor already. And went and moved into a rural area. We're actually living in the Columbia Gorge now for my husband's career. And took about 5 years off to become a mom. And when my son hit kindergarten and I kind of looked around and thought about what to do, the opportunities in a non-metropolitan area for environmental science were few and far between. So I spent some time as a land use planner and got to write a local critical areas ordinance and learn a little bit about where the rubber hits the road in terms of human ecology. And since about 2002, reading Fridtjof Capra's The Hidden Connections, the subtitle is A Science for Sustainable Living. He had actually looked at how are organizations literally living systems? And so that had really piqued my interest about how do we explore ecology on ourselves? Like, what does ecology mean for the study of society? And actually, I was looking at the Holacracy website that one of my clients, I was just doing some basic, you know, writing and research and general sort of geeky brain help for some few clients getting myself started. And one of my clients sent me the Holacracy link, and I saw their Glass Frog software, which is a software system to track how roles are assigned and how a company runs under Holacracy. And it is cell structure. It's a bunch of nested circles. And it's just like cells and organelles. And I just had this aha moment of like, oh, this is cell structure. That's why organizations are nested living systems. And they're not organisms, which also is a common metaphor. They do not have a bounded physical chemical barrier. But that piqued my interest. And I started to just talk about systems and do some projects, get some concrete examples. I still find it very difficult to articulate clearly why systems thinking and complexity research is so important. But once you get talking about specific problems that people are facing and begin to bring these ways of looking at the world to their specific situation, people begin to see the value very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Great. And, you know, I'm an organization geek. I think you're an organization geek, but maybe people listening are not so familiar with this sort of strange pursuit. And I'm curious if you would be willing to explain why is it so important that we think clearly about how we choose to design organizations?
Well, that's a really interesting question. The idea that we can choose to design an organization, I think, is up for question. When you look at the sciences that study complex adaptive systems, which cover physics, math, chemistry, biology, there's a whole bunch of sciences that are looking at complex adaptive systems from all sorts of angles. One thing that becomes very clear is they cannot be designed. They can be disturbed, which is, I don't mean in the sense of the word disturbing, but I mean like perturbed. Like you can add an input and watch and see what happens, but you cannot design them because you can't predict what's going to happen because they are too complex. If people are interested in going into that, the work on the Kinevan framework by Dave Snowden is very interesting, looking at probe, sense, respond, how to investigate complex systems. Not to get too geeky on that, but people, I think, for a long time have used the idea of the organization as an organism or as a ecosystem as a metaphor. But you are a living system. I am a living system. Any conglomeration of people are living systems that are interacting with each other. So at least in some part, and especially around the information flows, which are however we mediate through our wonderful technologies, the fundamental thing that changes information is somebody making a decision, even if it's whoever's designing the algorithm. And so organizations are literally living systems. And it's very interesting to me, as I got interested in organizational design, I discovered there were a lot of people from the tech world. There were a lot of people from human psychology, sort of the social sciences that were very interested in happiness in the workplace. How do we basically healthy organizational ecologies, but although they didn't say it that way, how do we make people happy at work and not feel like cogs in a machine? And the lack of people in the organizational design world who have a background in complex adaptive system sciences is really interesting. And the lack of awareness that organizational design exists at all, if you talk to living system scientists, they kind of are like, what? Business? I don't want to think about business that much. I think about geology or biology or, you know, whatever they do. And this is a gap that I think is very important to bridge if we're going to understand the organization as a literal living system. The reason that that's important, I think, it's important on many, many levels. Take climate change. If we're going to be able to respond and adapt rapidly to the number of changes coming through. We are seeing increasingly social, ecological, economic crises all over the globe. We need our organizations to be able to act with way more intelligence than we can. The traditional hierarchy that is designed, that is a designed system, and before our technology was the only way to coordinate large numbers of people. Because we didn't have the ability to communicate in a self-organizing way because the technology didn't support that. So hierarchies had their place. They have their place within any living system. There's nested hierarchies within your body, cells, you know, anything. So I'm not so saying throw away hierarchy. But that command and control structure, the traditional sort of business as usual, limits any decision to the intelligence of the smartest person in charge of that decision. Whereas when you begin to act in a way that respects the organization as a living system, you begin to free up the intelligence so you actually have the intelligence of however many people are in the organization as they're expressing their individual agency.
Fantastic. And I think one of the reasons I was so drawn to your work is because, like I mentioned, we first connected on this online community about organization design. And it was just so clear to me that you were really coming from a different place. You know, there were all these people sort of very much in their head trying to make, not that there's anything wrong with that, but they're very much coming from an intellectual place, trying to get, like you said, workers to be happier, things to be more efficient. But it really felt like you were coming from a heart space. Mm-hmm. Your heart was very much in it, into how we think about how we design and live in organizations. And I guess I'm curious, like, what is the role of the heart in thinking about these sorts of issues?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that I feel very strongly that we have a responsibility in this generation, in these generations alive today. We have kind of a do or die moment around climate change and how the Earth is going to go forward in human history. And the organization seems to be an incredibly powerful tool to allow information to be learned and absorbed by many people very rapidly. And one of the people in that organizational design community, Clay Parker Jones, has said it very well, that he looks at the dissemination of massively world-changing technologies, such as the loom, the printing press, and of course the personal computer. They've all been driven by large-scale organizations, which a lot of the time, both the startup community, the kind of agile company community, and the ecological community certainly make them into the villains. And so I very much like the idea of leveraging these big, powerful organizations to begin to act as self-organizing systems. And if you talk to individual, I mean, I do believe from the heart that people are basically good, and that the basis of organizational change is personal change, because it is the expression of collective intelligence.
Hmm. Wonderful. And that actually gets to another topic I'd love to hear your thoughts on, which is another reason why I really enjoyed talking to you is that you talk a lot about mindfulness practice. I mean, you often would just kind of say, I think on this Slack community, you know, we should just breathe or something to that effect, you know, remember the breath, basically. And you would recommend books about practice, about contemplative practice. And I'm curious, what does all that have to do with organizational design? You know,
well, first of all, there's a wonderful story from, I can't remember what tribe, I think it was Ursula Le Guin, was interviewing somebody in a South American tribe, and they said something about, you Americans have so many love songs. We have so many songs about water. Hmm. We need water. We live in a very arid region. Do you have so many love songs because you lack love? So maybe I really like mindfulness because I have a monkey brain that really needs it. But yeah, I think that you know, if you look at the leadership classes, if you look at people within the responsive communities who are looking at how do we change these big organizations, a lot of the time when they're talking to the historically the leadership of a company and encouraging in this new paradigm of self-organizing systems everybody to be a leader in their own way, you're talking about personal change. You're talking about being able to have self-confidence, being able to act from a place of love rather than fear, and make hard decisions while standing in that core of yourself, which I think mindfulness, and for me, probably because I'm such a monkey mind, The body-mind practices have been very, very useful. I've practiced Aikido for a long time. Well, that's part of the shift. If you look at any field today, economics, politics, biology, psychology, any field, really, you're going to find at the edges of that field some expression of the shift from Descartes to Darwin, which is sort of how I frame this major paradigm shift that we're going through. And the Cartesian way was to think of the world as a machine, clockwork. Einstein kind of helped knock that off because quantum physics is so weird. but the Darwinian look at evolution and what came from that out of the articulation of the ecological sciences really began the study of complex adaptive systems. And that shift is made possible. Like, you can't express yourself well, you cannot embody your own leadership qualities without feeling confidence in the core of yourself. So I think that the expression of collective intelligence, yes, it's important to look the way we communicate with others, but it starts with your trust in yourself.
Can you explore that a bit more? I'm really interested in collective intelligence and how to unlock it. And what is the relationship between trust and collective intelligence?
Well, I love the quote from David Suzuki. I'll paraphrase, that true compassion is having the ability to respond freely without fear of hurting oneself or others. And I think the Dalai Lama has said something very similar. I can't remember the quote right now, but I think that really relates to this. If you look at the adaptive, responsive, agile organization communities, there's a paradigm shift looking at not only networks, even over hierarchies, but also open even over private, or open even over closed, as the default. So right now, this sort of idea that in business as usual, we have the idea that knowledge is power. And so people kind of hold tightly, and like, if they let you in the know, that's a political power play. And in this new paradigm, you want to have your system set up so that anybody can pull information as they need it and have only the very proprietary, very, protected, whatever absolutely needs to be protected, or your organization will fail. Anything else needs to be open by default. And that shift requires an incredible amount of trust. It's interesting to look at the difference here, I think, between a network and a community. And if you think of your Twitter network, you would never send a shout out to say, the windstorm blew over my barn, I'm going to rebuild it, please come help. Like, that's your community.
Yeah.
The people who are, maybe you don't know them, maybe you don't talk to them, but you have some sort of, and maybe it comes down to place. Although there's community as a practice that you would send a shout out like that to. So I think it comes down to a combination of place and trust. Networks are very powerful in moving information rapidly and in supporting people in learning. The more we learn to learn out loud, the quicker we will learn together. And networks are wonderful for that. The weak ties in networks that are linking people with very, very different ideas are extremely important. And that's the bridge I want to build that I talked about before, between the org design folks and the complex adaptive systems sciences. However, it's really important when you're doing a specific project on the ground to identify the communities that are around that project or the change effort or whatever it is. And I think a community is a kind of a network, so there's a little bit of blurriness, but a community actually has some basis of real trust, where a network doesn't really need it. I mean, just to be a network, to function as a network. Not that trust is not great for a network as well. Yeah.
So you wrote a really interesting article about sustainability and the relationship between that and kind of how we think about information systems. And one of the topics you discussed briefly is how designing organizations or designing information systems in a new way will help us address what you call wicked problems. And I'm curious if you could describe first, what are wicked problems?
Wicked problems are, say, you know, stuff like climate change, for example. You have these all sorts of influences. It's extremely difficult to wrap your head around all of the causal factors involved, to keep them straight. It's very, very easy for people to get very polarized, I think, on wicked problems, because actual understanding of them takes far more than the normal soundbite media. And I think they're just, you know, it's kind of another name for things happening in a complex adaptive system that we would rather didn't happen.
Great. That's a great definition. And you know, I'm personally really interested in the issue of climate change, and there are other, you know, huge social issues that you know, might be things like wicked problems, like, you know, mm-hmm. how do we make a better economic system, mm-hmm. for instance. And you talked about this a little bit, but I'd love to explore in greater depth. How does the kind of work that you're doing and the kind of this way of thinking about how systems relate to each other, how does that help us begin to think about how we resolve, or even just straight up resolve, those larger social issues?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to steal a perspective on this straight out of a really interesting new initiative called the Next System Project. And what they're trying to do is to engage the mainstream public in a national conversation about what the next system looks like. And basically the first step to that is to admit that this is a systemic problem, whatever crisis you're talking about, be it ecological, social, economic, whatever. They're all systemic problems. We need to begin to talk about systems in a way that people's eyes don't glaze over and it's not just a geek fest. And I think one of the best articulations of that is just being able to talk about systems as a nested network of relationships, because people understand social networks. They understand, or at least, you know, they're familiar with them. And they understand sort of relationships can be complicated, but they can also be very, very powerful agents of change. There's a TED talk by a chef named Dan Barber called How I Fell in Love with a Fish that looks at how to get a actually sustainable fish on the plate, which is increasingly challenging if you know anything about what's happening in the oceans. And he has this, you know, 20-minute TED talk that's all about system thinking, and I don't think he uses the word system more than twice, maybe. And he talks about relationships and makes metaphors, and that's so, you know, grounding ourselves in, you know, at least on the organizational design, well, really organizational change, since they can't really be designed. Organizational change geeks need to have a complex adaptive systems understanding. I truly believe that. But we also really need to then be able to translate the geek talk into understandable story, narrative, metaphors, that sort of thing, that can engage a public conversation around systemic change. And I think that one of the most engaging ways to do that, again, just like I said, in trying to explain what I do to people, I start with their problems. So in engaging a national conversation, the Next System Project is starting with what's working. The government at the federal level is definitely broken. So let's look at what communities are doing. what are the solutions people are coming up with, and how are they similar? What are we seeing across those solutions that can scale across rather than scaling up? How do we create a solution in Florida that's going to work in Maine? Or, you know, how can we look at a solution if we live in one place from a different place that has some similar attributes, sort of like resilience preparedness up and down the Pacific coast is something that the communities can exchange information on and begin to scale across.
That's very pragmatic. I like it. That's great. And so you've mentioned this a little bit about the need for, I think, the interdisciplinary communication between adaptive systems folks or the people studying that kind of science, mm-hmm. and as we might refer to them as organizational geeks. Mm-hmm. What exactly do the adaptive science folks have to teach the organization geeks?
Well, I think a lot of the organizational change folks tend to, number one, wonder how, if we're not doing hierarchies, what are we doing? Which is really kind of another way of saying, how do we design the next organization? I really like the Harvard Business Professor, Amy Edmondson, has a book called Teaming, which looks at what individual behaviors do you need to support in your leadership efforts in order to allow people to self-organize and do what she calls teaming, which is a skill of working in teams of people that maybe you don't know well, and still being able to communicate freely and openly and not have hierarchical fear of retribution, that sort of thing, reduce the amount of information flow that happens. She uses hospitals as a great example, because there's life and death consequences. People are interacting with people they don't know all the time. And if you're not good at teaming, it can have fatal consequences. So I really think that a bottom-up approach is where it needs to begin. And I think that is very clear when you come from the complex adaptive system side. I think that, well, as much as I had my aha moment looking at the Holacracy website, I don't think Holacracy is going to be widely adapted all over the place, because it is kind of a handbook. Here's what you do. And while I think it's a fantastic first start, because a lot of the other, you know, there are not many handbooks on what to do if you don't want to do hierarchy. But I love the idea, rather than starting at the here's the whole processes that we put over the whole organization, to start with what individual behaviors do we need to see if you work at our organization, in order to have that expression of collective intelligence to start actually self-organizing. It takes a lot of trust. And it's really scary a lot of the time, because you move forward. It's sort of like, you remember Indiana Jones walking across the bridge he couldn't see? That's sort of what you have to do.
Great metaphor. I love it. That works for a lot of things, actually.
There's Ursula Le Guin again. She was, I think maybe, I don't know if it was the same interview or a different one, but there's a tribe in South America, again, that thinks of the future as behind them, and the past as in front. And so they think of themselves walking backwards into the future, because the past is what they can see. Hmm. The future is sneaking up on them. And I think you have to kind of be willing to walk backwards. And that's actually a really interesting, I hadn't thought about that before, the connection between that and mindfulness practices, and especially mind-body practices. One of the first things that one of my Aikido teachers would say is really, really important is lie on the floor and know where your back is. Because we're so visual, we're so brainy, We've spent so much of our evolutionary effort getting up on our feet and walking forward with our eyes and brains and hands free, but we've really forgotten about how to sense where we are in our bodies and being able to sort of have that eyes in the back of your head sense in your body is part of what gives you this inner self-confidence to become a good leader in an adaptive organization. Mm. And that ability to walk forward into the future, even though you don't know what it looks like. It's emergent. That's the thing about complex adaptive systems. The solutions are not designed. They emerge. Mm. And you have to trust that. If you're going to work from, you know, from a standpoint that's not driven by fear. If you don't trust it, you're scared. So.
Right. And, I guess I'm curious what words of advice you might give to a leader in an organization who is interested in shifting into this sort of way of working, but might not really know how. Like, what's a good first step?
A really interesting first step is to find some sort of collective knowledge mapping tool or game. There's hundreds available. And look at what the people in your organization already know about what changes are needed and just start gathering that information. And, you know, of course, then you have the internal leadership skills about allowing yourself to admit where you're blocking communication, where you're using political power or whatever to not have to hear the bad things people want to say that would actually help your organization. So the whole idea of a wall of failure, making mistakes. Oh, I had a wonderful, I'm visiting family and was in San Anselmo the other day, which is the birthplace of Star Wars, and standing next to the statue of Indiana Jones and Yoda, and watching the kids play. And there was a little boy who was probably about 4 years old, drawing with chalk with his older sister. And she was very involved in drawing something. And he drew something and he stood up and he said, "Hey, I made something." And she looked up and he said, "I made a mistake." And I love that attitude. Like, oh yeah. My God, that's so succinct. Like being excited. Oh my God, I made a mistake. And it's so cool. It's like, what can I learn from that? That's one of the things that complex adaptive system scientists can teach. They are not scared of mistakes because, geez, science is mistakes upon mistakes. That's what a hypothesis is like. How can I make this mistake, basically?
Yeah, and hearing you talk about that, it's striking how many parallels there are to contemplative practice. You know, I remember this quote that says that the life of a Zen master is one mistake after another. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just your advice to basically trust what wants to emerge and stop running from what you're afraid of. Mm-hmm. You know. What better advice is there for us as individuals mm-hmm. than that too? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so elegant the way these systems of thought align.
Yeah, it gives me a lot of hope. The fact that these conversations are happening across all sorts of fields is very, very exciting. And it's kind of one of the only things that counterbalances the dread of the future that so many of the crises bring up.
Very cool. And so we talked a little bit about, you know, how a leader might start to invoke some of these potential changes in perspective. But then, you know, one of the things I'm really interested in is speaking to people who are kind of straddling this more hopeful worldview with one that, with being tied to more broken systems, let's just say broken systems.
Yeah, how do we create the next system while we live in this one?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, what words might you give to folks in that situation? Because I think it's such a common situation. And I really want, part of the purpose of this show is really to kind of give people, show people that there are different ways of being in this world.
Well, I'm going to be a little bit radical here, I guess.
Perfect.
For me, it really came down. I mean, I've struggled with this question a long time because it's so difficult to hope for the better future that I do, and to live in this world and constantly be, you know, supporting all sorts of things that I wish didn't exist, fossil fuels and whatever. I mean, it's easy to have black and white thinking and make them the devil, but if you actually look around your life, you have an ecological footprint, and if you live in America, you have a large ecological footprint. For me, it really has come down recently to ownership and looking at regenerative ownership structures like co-ops, like partnerships. Most of the fairly new consultancies that are spinning out of the online community of responsive, adaptive, organizational geeks are very, you know, they're all partners. They don't have owners and employees. They're all owners in some way. So there's all sorts of ways. There's, you know, mission-driven corporations. There's B Corps. There's different ways to ensure that the values of the next system are embedded in your this system organization. But I think that the solutions won't really come about until the financial next system is starting to be built. And I really think some of the blockchain technology, which is incredibly not green right now, by the way, although people are working on that. But I really, you know, I've had people who are in that world, who know a lot about Bitcoin and blockchain, say, you know, the next 5 or 10 years, you won't even ever have to say Bitcoin or blockchain, but your transactions on your Visa will be completely different than they are now. The technology behind them will allow this very secure, very distributed technology to support it. And when that begins to happen, then you begin to be able to distribute value as it's created. So if you're co-creating stuff in a loose network of weak connections, you can still gain value, you know, get financially compensated in a very different way than a traditional paycheck. So I'm very excited about both the new organizational, or not so new, you know, some co-op structures have been around for a long time, but ownership structures and what is the new technology that we have within the blockchain and Bitcoin going to do to the financial system?
Cool. Yeah, and I think many people are pretty mystified by Bitcoin and blockchain technology.
Makes my brain hurt.
Yeah, me too. I'm curious if you can, you know, you mentioned how this will change the way that we make transactions. Like, can you just kind of describe what that might look like for us as individuals? Like, how will my life be different?
I think it would be different in, I don't think it would be different in everyday transactions that you already do. I think it would be different in the ability, for example, if the organizational design community that we're a part of decided we're going to build a piece of software and we're going to make it available because we think it's necessary, and we built it and it started to make money, we would have an ability while we're building it using blockchain technology to track people's contributions, and not just the coders, but the community would be able to vote on, oh yeah, that was a great call, and you know, that was really necessary, and that made this project fly. And your community of practice, the people who you're working with, if you're engaged on a project together, you know who's contributing and who's not. I mean, people working out loud see each other. And if you have this sort of, it's almost like a meritocracy, really, where you get value assigned, then when that goes out in the world and begins to make money, you have profit coming in, and it may be in very small increments, but you may be involved in hundreds of projects in this new paradigm of working in networks.
Cool. And, you know, one thing that I think a lot about, it feels increasingly to me, and maybe that's just because I get to have awesome conversations like this regularly, but it feels to me like the world ahead of is, in fact, pretty abundant for those who are able to take advantage of new opportunities, assuming we don't, you know, just destroy everything.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much inequity. There's so much imbalance when it comes to distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if the work that you do has anything to, can shed any light on that. Like how do we approach inequality and inequity from systems perspective?
Well, I am again going to just steal a wonderful project that has been looking at doing that, which is the work of the Evonomics magazine and Joe Brewer, and the newly formed, and I think really won't really launch until next year officially, but it's a society for the study of culture, cultural evolution. And they were writing and doing a lot of things around the September announcement of the Sustainable Development Goals from the UN about reframing the question on poverty to look at it as a systemic problem. But I, again, you know, I encourage people to look at that project. I think it's amazing. And again, I just think it comes back to, if you're really going to have a self-organizing system, you need distributed power. Distributed power fundamentally comes from ownership. You can be as great a boss as you possibly can. You can be a wonderful leader. And if you own all the company, it's just, you can't really get to a truly self-organizing, free and open system. Yes. So, you know, you have to look greed and this very basic human desire for security and power and wealth right in the face to look at poverty. So there's no reason today, from a very, you know, financial, logistical, resources point of view, that anybody should be living in poverty. But we live in the old system. So.
Yeah. Cool. Well, as we start to wind up the show, is there anything that you'd like to say or any questions that you want to dive into before we close?
Oh, this has been so fun. Thank you. I'm really glad that you're doing these interviews. I don't know. I do think one thing that I wanted to mention is a wonderful graph by a fellow up at University of Washington, Jevin West, did a radial graph that's actually looks at the citations within academic journals. So you can actually see which disciplines really draw from other disciplines and which don't. And molecular and cell biology draws from everybody. I mean, you look at the connections that they have on this radial graph, and they cover the whole graph. They're drawing from history and astrophysics and mathematics and all of this stuff. And you look at economics, and it's this little U that comes right back into economics. So the economic journals cite each other, and they don't look at anything else. So I think that busting open the discipline of economics to make it truly transdisciplinary will begin, you know, is part of what really needs to happen, because so much of this comes down to money, to, you know, how we have security and power as people.
Yeah, which relates again back to ownership. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Christina, for coming on the show. It's been a really, really fascinating conversation. I know it's a good conversation when I regularly get, chills while the person is speaking. So I really appreciate all that you shared.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Daniel.
Yeah, and thank you for the work you do. I think it's really important.
You too. get these conversations and stories out there.